Welcome to In Gad We Trust, a podcast based in and around classic era golden age detective fiction of the 1920s to the 1940s. My name is Jim, I blog at The Invisible Event, and the plan for this podcast is that each episode features me in conversation with fellow bloggers, with authors, with enthusiasts in the genre, to talk about a topic of their choosing. Joining me for this episode is author Ryan O'Neill. Ryan, welcome to In Gad We Trust.
Thanks for having me.
What are we going to be talking about today, Ryan? I mean, it's in the episode title, obviously, but some people don't read those.
Well, today we're going to talk about the idea of genre, especially in the field of golden age detection. What is genre? Is it useful, or is it really just a marketing gimmick for where booksellers put books on their shelves?
Fantastic. Now, just to establish Ryan's bona fides to be talking about genre, I would like to give a plug to his most recent book, The Drover's Wives. Ryan, could you just talk us through the principle behind The Drover's Wives and how this has led to us coming to talk about genre on my detective fiction podcast?
So The Drover's Wives is a collection of 101 different retellings of a famous Australian short story called The Drover's Wife. As you can probably tell from my accent, I am Australian. Well, actually, or I've lived in Australia for 15 years, but haven't actually lost the accent. But The Drover's Wife is the most famous Australian short story. It's iconic. It's been retold through film, through painting, through other short stories over the years. And it's essentially a very simple story published in the 1890s. And it's about a woman who lives in the bush with her four children, and her husband, the drover of the title, is away with the sheep. A black snake, which is a deadly snake, comes along, goes under the house. The drover's wife waits up all night with a stick. At the end of it, in the morning, the sun comes up, the snake comes out, and she beats the snake to death with the stick. And that's essentially the story. But it's very iconic in Australia, and it is a bit more exciting than it sounds. But so I decided to jump into that tradition and to retell it in 101 different ways. Basically lots and lots of different genres and forms, including a cryptic crossword, an insurance claim, a golden age detective mystery, poetry, a bush ballad, a musical number, a pop song, in the style of Ernest Hemingway, in the style of Cormac McCarthy, in the style of a penthouse letter. Part of the fun I have as a writer is experimenting with genre and telling stories in different ways and different forms.
That sounds perfect. So I guess let's jump into then the notion of genre and the notion of the detective novel. Is that a good place to start? What do you think we're talking about when we mean the genre with regards to the detective novel?
You know, everyone's got a slightly different definition of detective fiction, but I think most people would generally agree in the modern sense it started with Poe in the 19th century. The idea of the great detective, the idea of the impossible crime, and so on. And it sort of flowered from there through Sherlock Holmes and into the early 20th century, Agatha Christie, and so on. But I think if you're going to talk about detective fiction, you've got to talk about a central detective. If you're talking about crime or mystery fiction, you maybe not necessarily have that central detective figure. But I think if we're talking about detective fiction as a genre, we've got a central detective. Could be amateur, could be professional. And they are uncovering a crime, generally a murder. And in this sort of subgenre that we all love, the golden age detective, the murder will generally occur in a middle class or upper class environment. It will generally be fairly bloodless. You know, we've got the classic, you know, the victim died instantaneously, which you see again and again. No matter how awful they are, they've got to die instantaneously. We don't want to feel too bad for them. Because, again, another aspect of the genre, the detective genre, we're maybe focused on the puzzle. We're focused on the puzzle. Arguably, and some critics might argue, to the detriment of the characters and the writing style. I think that's true in some cases, we'll probably touch on, but also think there are some writers who do a wonderful job of characterization, and they are lovely stylists as well. So yeah, the detective genre, you know, we can break it down into its many, many sub-genres as well. And this is where we come to the idea of whether the idea of genre is useful, because it can be broken down so much. There are crossover genres. There's science fiction and detectives. There are, you know, Isaac Asimov stories and novels. But yeah, so I think with the genre, we're looking at various rules, various tropes, and of course, perhaps the most exciting writers are the ones who experiment and play and occasionally break those rules and tropes as well.
So I think we should probably start off then with an observance of why this idea of genre is so important to the detective novel. Because essentially what we want is we want, like you say, a crime to have occurred, there to be some attempt at solving it, and for us, the reader, to generally engage with that to some extent or another. Now, I think this is part of why, I mean, already we're going to start splitting hairs, because this is why we talk about fair play detective fiction, because it's possible to follow along and see all the clues the detective sees. Equally, it's possible to tell a detective story in which the detection occurs, but we're not necessarily privy to a lot of the clues or a lot of the detective's thinking. Something like The Maltese Falcon by Dashiell Hammett, for instance, more of a crime novel, even though its central concept is a detective who we follow in every single scene going about the solution of a crime. But essentially, I suppose the notion of detective fiction as a genre enables us, the readers, to get some sense of what we're getting out of that reading experience. You don't want to read, let's say, The Hollow Man by John Dixon Carr to get to the end and discover that actually it was all ghosts. Mm. Or you don't want to read The Poison Chocolates Case to then get to the end and go, oh yeah, we've got absolutely no idea how this was solved. So there are definitely these trappings, there are definitely these tropes, but it's fair to say that with genre, where the detective novel is concerned, but also I think with genre generally, it's starts off as a way for the reader to be reassured of the kind of story they're picking up. Is that fair?
Yes, there's definitely be some disappointment if you don't get what you expect. And you often see that in, you know, Amazon reviews. People will buy a book and they'll leave a ridiculous review because it wasn't what they thought it was going to be, even based on the cover or based on what someone told them. So people do want to know what they're getting. And I think the wonderful thing about detective fiction by the best writers is that those writers will give the reader what they want, but generally something extra as well. Something unexpected, something the reader is maybe not looking for, something that comes out of left field. Otherwise, it just becomes formulaic. And that's, you know, that was, and to an extent still is, the big one of the big accusations leveled against detective fiction. It's a genre. It's almost a mathematical equation, you know, X plus Y equals B, which means Z killed Q.
I've read that book.
Sometimes, like maybe some of the early, you know, early Ellery Queen novels sometimes feel like that. When we're going through interviews with 1,000 suspects, we've got long lists of timetables. But even Queen took the genre he was working in and he adapted it as time went on, and genre does change as well. There's a big difference between someone like Ellery Queen or someone like S.S. Van Dyne to someone even 4 or 5 years later, where we see it becomes less of a puzzle and less of an equation, and characterization does start come into it. So, I think in the end, genre is a useful thing for the reader. It can be a useful thing for the writer to know what you're getting, but if it doesn't want to ossify, then it does have to change or adapt or play with the expectations of the reader.
Hmm. Okay. So then, let's start, I guess, from the very beginning. You talked about Poe being essentially where I think most people would agree the notion of detective fiction began, which is not to say it can't move outside of it. We'll get into that. But it started off as a form of realist literature, right, which was trying to represent physical space that the readers would recognise. It would represent a physical milieu that would represent realistic characters coming to realistic conclusions based on realistic evidence. On the back of that, what you then got was your Superman detective, the ultimate Superman detective that came in the form of Sherlock Holmes, where the declaration of the clues and the reader's awareness of the information that Holmes has became less and less and less of a factor. Is that then, you think, the first point at which the detective fiction really started to transmogrify from what it had originally started out as? Do you think that's the first instance where we can look at the changes occurring within the genre?
I think, to go back to your first point, I would disagree that it began as an attempt at realism. For me, and it's not intended as a criticism of detective fiction, I see it as an inherently artificial genre, in that it assumes that the world makes sense, and it assumes that the world can be explained. And I think straight away that assumption is incorrect. Yeah. For me, that detective fiction, you know, in the most positive way, is almost like a sonnet. You know, a sonnet has rules, it's constrained. You know, a Shakespearean sonnet has 14 lines, it's got a rhyme scheme it has to follow, it's got 5 beats per line, the iambic pentameter. So it's an incredibly constrained literary form. Yet within those constraints, Shakespeare and other writers have, you know, managed to perform miracles of poetry and feeling and emotion within this constrained artificial genre. So even going back to Poe, well, he did bring in the idea that the detective was observing and drawing order from the chaos. Murders in the Rue Morgue is an inherently ridiculous story. You know, it is ridiculous. We've got the orangutan. Where did the sailor even get the orangutan? Why has the orangutan got a razor blade? You know, and again, you're quite right. It's not fairly clued. So although Poe definitely started the detective tradition, I would say, I think even at that stage, there was an element of artificiality to it.
Okay.
That, to, for my mind, continued and has continued throughout the detective tradition, for me.
But something like The Mystery of Marie Roget, the second story, has that lack of closure. There is no showdown. There is no definite answer made in terms of who murdered her. Spoilers, but these things are very old. So I suppose I was thinking about right back at the beginning. I mean, yeah, I absolutely acknowledge Murders in the Rue Morgue is a hideously unrealistic story. But I suppose I was thinking of Mystery of Marie Roget. I mean, for a start, it's spun out of a series of newspaper articles. And there's no basis for most of what Dupin comes up with. A lot of what Dupin comes up with is inherently ridiculous and relies on these wonderful generalities that can't possibly be true. And again, there is no closure to that. It's just that, well, it could possibly be something like this, and then the story ends. Poe doesn't even impose his own false form of solution upon it. At the end of last year, Christian Henriksen and I picked through a bunch of Poe's stories of ratiocination. So we did Rue Morgue, we did Marie Roget, we did The Purloined Letter, we did Thou Art the Man, and then we went into the less commonly observed ones. And there's a lot of, oh, I saw this guy and I followed him around in a crowd, which is the man in the crowd, who just follows a guy around in a crowd for a particular reason, and comes to some conclusions and draws certain parallels and things like that. But again, there's no real driving narrative purpose to it. So I suppose I was thinking Holmes was the first point, realistically, where an actual narrative arc was definitely guaranteed as part of a story involving detection. So that was possibly the first point where that change came in, because you read some of these Poe stories of ratiocination and you get to the end and go, okay, but who was the man in the crowd? What was the point of spotting that guy and following it? It's deliberately left open. There's a wonderful, this is much later on, but there's a wonderful Stanley Ellen short story where a gentleman is listening to two guys talking about a court case on a train. And one of the people in this conversation is detailing what happened and the way in which this guy ended up accused of this crime. And then his twin brother gets up and goes, oh no, well, it wasn't him, it was me. And at this point, the narrator has to get off the train and so has absolutely no idea how that story ends and what becomes of that story. And there's that similar lovely sort of, you know, you're expecting this narrative closure, this sense of, ah, but here's the clever way in which they caught the guilty party. And actually what happens is this reality interrupts and his stop comes up and he has to get off the train. And the thing I love about that, I think it was published in the 50s, is that by that point there would have been such an accepted norm of, I mean, not so much character arcs, certainly these plot arcs where Chekhov's gun comes up on page 1 and is fired on page 17. So I suppose that's why I was talking about it being sort of fairly realistic before. But you start to introduce that element of unrealism, and indeed a heightened unrealism just on account of who Holmes is and the nature of Holmes's character. And so I wonder if that's why those stories are still so hotly debated and so kind of widely admired even to this day.
Yeah, I think, as you said, it's definitely a factor is the beginning, middle and end in every Holmes story and novel, and the cluing, which is sometimes fair and sometimes not. But I think, you know, even shortly after Holmes, there were writers who wrote better puzzles and more fairly clued puzzles. But I think a lot of the Holmes success is actually the depiction of Holmes and Watson. There have been many, many Watson characters, again, the whole subgenre of Watson characters, Hastings, yeah. Archie, Goodwin, and so on. So I think while Conan Doyle did bring in, you know, a fairly rigorous, you know, beginning, middle and end, setting up the idea of, you know, the client comes to the detective investigates, detective solves the crime and either lets the criminal go or brings the criminal to justice. That was very much brought about by Holmes. I think that alone would not have guaranteed its longevity. I think, as we've seen in the hundreds, if not thousands, of pastiches and films, it's the genius of the writing, you know, how Conan Doyle was able, in, with fairly broad strokes, to create Holmes and Watson, and really to cement and solidify the great detective figure, which was to dominate the genre.
That's probably fair. So as we're going to talk about the detective story, we can take to be implicit with that this idea of, yeah, I agree, this false air of closure and this fake sense of everything that happens having some sort of significance, whether it's directly on the central plot, whether it's on some B or C plot love story or whatever it is. We're relayed a series of events, and every single event that happens in that narrative is going to have some relevance to what's going on. The detective story is not unique in guaranteeing a closed arc, but do you think that is part of the appeal, that even as it goes through all these transformations, the one thing you are guaranteed out of it is a closed arc in which every event has some bearing on some element of the story?
My theory is that is a big part of its attraction. I think the reason why detective fiction and crosswords both became hugely popular after the Great War was that they made sense. You know, they're a small scale, they're something that you can solve. You can feel a sense of achievement solving them. In some ways, the detective novel is like a cryptic crossword, and if it arguably gets pushed too far by writers like Van Dyne and Queen in the early days. So, and it also, it takes violence, and it, you know, it does make it bloodless. You know, but we're really not, and generally we don't care about the victim. Occasionally I have read detective novels where I was sorry to see the victim go, but generally we don't care about them, and generally we're not meant to care about them. The reason for the continuing success of detective fiction, even as it's moved away from the Golden Age into crime, is just it's the need for story. And I think out of maybe any genre, the detective genre is the purest in terms of story. It's, as you said, it's everything in a good detective novel. Everything is geared towards the final solution. And I think for me, that's one of the reasons why I love it so much, is that I feel like when I've come to the end of a good detective novel and I'm on the last chapter and the detective gives their explanation, and suddenly you realise that you've read a completely different novel. You've essentially, it creates a new novel. It rewrites the entire novel in that last chapter, which no other genre can do, in my opinion. Everything that you thought was true has been turned entirely on its head. And that's the only time I get that feeling is with detective fiction. And sadly, as I get older and the more and more that I read of it, the less and less often that happens. And so I think that has got to be a factor in the enjoyment of detective fiction. I think there's also an element that W.H. Auden discussed in his essay, The Guilty Vicarage. And to me, this does apply to me personally as well, is that I enjoy entering an environment of order as a reader, seeing that environment upended and disturbed and the order restored at the end. There's something inherently satisfying about that for me as a reader. And I know that a lot of people don't find that satisfying, and therefore they will not like detective fiction. But something like if you read John Dixon Carr or Haig Talbot, where the supernatural intrudes into the world, and at the end it's you know, the impossible, the literally impossible, is explained away in a satisfying manner. But again, there's just nothing, no kind of fiction does that, gives that jolt of pure story adrenaline that you get in The Red Right Hand, or that you get in The Hollow Man, or that you get in Rim of the Pit. So I think, for me, that the appeal of detective fiction is that one word story, which has a flip side, where it's a downside, where the story can become formulaic, the characters can be cardboard. But at its best, I think it's story. That's what it just delivers, a jolt of pure story. And that's why I think it's popular and has remained popular.
Was the Golden Age novel unique inside a genre in being very self-examining? Because, for instance, I've read a certain amount of epic fantasy, and they are all, very unironically, about a forgotten orphan lad who lives in a tiny hamlet in the shade of a great mountain in a land ruled over by powerful wizards, who, over a 950-page first book, and then probably an 1,100-page second book, and then a 1,400-page third book, and then a 1,700-page fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh book, discovers that he is, in fact, a magical wizard who is strong enough to beat the magical wizards and bring peace to his homeland. That's the entire genre of epic fantasy. There's never any sense of, we need to turn around and internally examine what we're doing, which is part of the reason why I got bored reading epic fantasy. I can't think of anything, and I'm very happy to be contradicted on this, but I can't think of anything else as a genre that examined itself and responded to its own innovations in the way that the detective story has over the years, starting with the Golden Age. I think is probably why we called it the Golden Age, because that was the point where it became very self-aware, and then went, oh, well, as I discussed with Alistair Beckett King a few weeks ago, well, you're expecting a Birlstone Gambit, so I'm not going to give you a Birlstone Gambit, or you're expecting Development X, so in fact Development X is the false solution, and I'm going to give you Development Y, which is also a false solution, and then I'm going to give you Development P, which is the real solution. And it strikes me that's the only genre that did that. Is that fair?
I would agree that a lot of detective fiction writers did write fiction that was obviously aware of the reader's expectations, but I think, you know, maybe we're more aware of that because that was often the best writers or the most inventive writers. I think there's a whole substratum of detective fiction that is just very ordinary. It was just entirely formulaic. And for that reason, it hasn't really survived. And even then, there are some writers like Neil Marsh. I do find her very formulaic. And I wonder, I think it's just her characterization that's kept her name alive. So I would agree that there were a lot of writers that were aware of the field they were working in, but I'd say it's the same with science fiction or fantasy. I mean, there's a fantasy novel called Mistborn, where there is a chosen one, but the story opens with the chosen one's defeat and the Dark Lord wins, and it goes from there. So there's a writer, Brandon Sanderson, who's aware that we've read a million epic fantasies, and straight away he's going to twist it and give you a different version of that. You know, I think detective fiction, because of its artificiality, writers were probably more aware maybe than in epic fantasy, even though, of course, epic fantasy is also inherently artificial. But maybe the writers of epic fantasy are happier to work within that sandbox that Tolkien created, whereas detective fiction writers, I feel like they wanted to change the rules of the game, or which you don't really, as you said, you don't really see in a genre like epic fantasy, which has become very, very hackneyed, so that when someone doesn't follow the genre, like Brandon Sanderson, it is very unusual. There's not many Brandon Sandersons in epic fantasy, but there are a lot of great detective fiction authors who played around with the reader's expectations in the way you said. So that's a long way of coming round to saying, yes, I would agree that I think I could have shortened that answer by 5 minutes just by saying yes. It's interesting that if that self-awareness is pushed, you write that the author does run the risk of losing the reader. You move out of the detective genre into something else, like postmodernism or the postmodern detective tale or something like that.
It's almost like we're very happy for there to be rules, we just don't really want our attention drawn to them. Or no, not even that. We don't want our attention drawn to them in such a way where the author almost feels like they wish to be congratulated for understanding what the rules are, right? Yep. It's like you wouldn't enjoy a game, let's say of, I don't know, football, where every time someone did something that was inside of the rules, they stopped and turned to the audience and went, look, I've just done something that's allowable inside of the game. You just want them to get on and play the game. Mm. And I think there's that aspect of, oh, well, look at me, I know the rules, and kind of drawing attention to it, which, and again, this is entirely subjective. Mm. If you're doing that for a reader who knows the rules, they'll know that you're doing it. And if you're doing that for a reader who doesn't know the rules, you're not going to get anything out of drawing their attention to it. And so it's not even really showing off. It's almost just like an insecurity thing, I suppose, which I don't really need. I don't need that aspect of interruption to my reading.
I think there's a thin line between clever and too clever by half.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's a definite thin line, and that's a line that I think I walk in my writing as well. You know, I remember once I sent off a short story. It was a story of a disintegrating marriage told through graphs and charts. And it came back with a rejection, and the rejection was just a post-it note which said, "Massively overcomplicates a simple premise." I thought, that's fair enough. That's pretty much what I was doing. But I enjoyed that. You know, as a reader, I sometimes enjoy it. And as a writer, I did enjoy writing it. Yes, I did massively overcomplicate a simple premise. And I think, I certainly wouldn't want every detective novel I read to be poking fun at the genre or saying, look at me, I'm subverting expectations. You know, aren't I clever? But I think that the genre can take it. It's strong enough that it can take those parodies. It can take the person playing around with it. And I'll be very interested if you ever get a chance to read Vladimir Nabokov's Despair, which is but the closest he comes to, well, it's a crime. It's an inverted crime novel, I suppose. And by the time you get to the end, you're either going to be laughing and congratulating Nabokov or wanting to build a time machine, go back and slap him in the face as to what he's done with the genre. Yeah. It's just I love those kind of stories as a refresher. You know, if you read five George Bellairs, you know, novels in a row, if they're fairly straightforward and entertaining, whatever, it can, you know, it can be good to read a story where the butler actually did do it for a change. You think, oh, okay, I wasn't expecting that. but yeah, no one likes the, and certainly Paul Auster has been accused of this, that, you know, it's almost masturbatory. You know, it's like, you know, who are you trying to impress with this? You know, it's empty intellectual posturing. And I think, yeah, as with any form of writing, it's very easy. There can be sort of good meta detective stuff, like The Face on the Cutting Room Floor by Cameron McKay, which is, in my opinion, a masterpiece. And there can be bad meta detective stuff. And maybe I could see why people would hate Gilbert Adair for that. But you're right, it does require a knowledge of that genre. But that's the same with any kind of parody or meta thing. If you haven't seen Star Wars and you watch Spaceballs, you're not going to laugh when yogurt comes on, you know, and use the Schwartz. So you're not going to know what's going on. So I don't know if we can hold that against those writers.
Yeah. Nice. Is there a discussion just to be had around the notion of then the rules of Golden Age detection? I mean, one of the criticisms levelled at the genre is that it does get a bit hidebound by the rules, and obviously there is a lot trotted out about the Knox Decalogue, slightly less, but still a fair amount trotted out about Van Dine's 20 Rules, which is essentially the Knox Decalogue and then a boring appendix. But I am certainly not aware of any other genre taking the time to sit down and codify itself. And obviously the Knox rules were not prescriptive. It was not, you must adhere to these 10 principles in order to write what we're going to call a detective novel. And Van Dine was not saying you must adhere to these 20 principles in order to write what is a detective novel. But if genre exists for stuff outside of the detective novel, I'm intrigued by the idea and the existence of rules, because it doesn't feel like the rules exist in any other genre. And we know someone like Harry Stephen Keeler went out of his way to play around with the rules as much as possible. And I think, honestly, this is part of the reason why virtually no one reads Harry Stephen Keeler these days, because your detective turns out to be a time traveller, or your killer turns up 2 pages from the end or something like this. Just, it seems weird to me to talk about genre and not address the idea of rules.
Bear with me, it seems like a weird crossover, but there is a really strong crossover between detective fiction and avant-garde French writing, i.e. the Oulipo. So the Oulipo were a bunch of French Gauloise-smoking intellectuals, a group of writers. They all got together in the 60s, and their big organising principle was that the writers would write under constraint. So they would choose a certain constraint. It might be, one of them was, write a poem in the time between two stops in the Paris metro.
Right.
That would be a constraint. And they called themselves rats who built their own mazes to escape from. And in a sense, that's actually what detective fiction is. You know, the detective fiction writer builds the maze and the for the detective, the rat, to escape through the maze. And so I think there's a crossover there between, because these French writers believed that you could unlock creativity through constraint. And I think that's what we see again and again in the Golden Age detective novel, is, as I said, it's like this really constrained form, and yet it had this absolutely remarkable flowering over two or three decades, depending when you want to start it, you know, with an almost infinite number of murders, motives, alibis, points of view, inverted mystery, locked rooms, subgenres, before it finally exhausted itself as it would have to do. That crossover, you know, continues in the Oulipo writer Georges Perec, who at the time of his sad early death was halfway through a detective novel. He was writing an Oulipian detective novel where he'd written the first half, and apparently the second half was going to kind of completely unpick the first half, but he never got around to writing it. I think that's the idea of rules is very, very important. I don't think any genre has been as codified as that. I know that Diane Wynne Jones wrote A Rough Guide to Fantasy. You know, we're kind of giving some of the tropes and things like that, but certainly nothing like Knox's Decalogue, which I think you pointed out in an excellent post. You know, crime writers today like to look at the Decalogue and take the mickey out of it and say, oh, aren't we so superior to that now? When in fact, if you look at what Knox was saying, and if you look at not just the one sentence, but the explanation of it, he was a very, very smart and astute critic of the form, and certainly some, you know, the modern crime writers could actually learn something in terms of cluing and in terms of fair play, because I'm certain you, like me, have opened up and read novels which say the next, you know, Agatha Christie, and you get to the end, you think, they didn't even tell me how could I have worked that out? There was no way I could have worked that out. But this isn't Agatha Christie, it's going back to blooming Poe. You know, so and yet those writers will sneer at Knox for his 10 rules. So again, I think that is something inextricably bound up to the genre. And I think that's almost what powers the genre and which gave it that fantastic flowering, is the authors working within the rules, the authors twisting the rules, the authors and the readers being aware of the rules, and that great game of back and forth being played with the readers. And again, certainly I think that is unique to detective fiction. I can't think of such a solidly codified list of rules that any other genre has.
The sadly missed blogger Noah Stewart, who kept probably one of the most valuable resources on detective fiction going on the web, his blog was called Noah's Archives, he said that the three genres where you can be guaranteed what will happen at the end before you've started it are detective fiction, the romance novel, and pornography. And I guess the question remains, why is it that specifically a set of rules exist for one genre, but possibly for no other ones? None.
I think the other genres obviously have the rules, because that's what makes them a genre, a certain set of rules. But I mean, horror obviously does have its rules. If you think about the Scream movies take the mickey out of the rules of horror. You know, don't ever say I'll be right back because you won't. Don't ever have sex with someone. Don't ever smoke drugs or drink alcohol because the killer will be after you. Any contemporary horror movie, you've got to have the scene nowadays where they look at their phone and say no signal, because otherwise it's just not going to work. So in that sense, that's an awareness of the genre right there, is that times have moved on. There needs to be no signal in order for the story to happen. Or like Susan Hill with her horror fiction set in the past, that's the other way to escape it. Yeah, what I think it is, I don't know why detective fiction was so explicitly codified. I mean, obviously, horror writers are aware of the genre they are working in. Stephen King has written some great books on horror and discussing the genre of horror and what works and what doesn't. But I think, you know, I think maybe the reason what I can go back to is that a horror novel can end in a number of ways. You know, the protagonist might go insane, the protagonist might escape, the protagonist might get killed, the protagonist might be possessed and go evil or whatever. But as you said, detective fiction has to have that one outcome, unless you're going to be really playing about with the form and, you know, we don't find out who the murderer is, which does happen occasionally. Mm-hmm. But maybe that's it. Maybe it's because the destination point is so fixed that, you know, the steps along the way are really quite fixed compared to other genres. I don't think there's ever been sort of 10 rules for horror fiction or 10 rules for fantasy fiction.
I mean, certainly if there has, possibly you've got 30 or 40 or 50 different versions of it, right? Where 30 or 40 or 50 different authors have all sat down and gone, well, these are my rules. What I find fascinating about detective fiction is that Knox wrote his Decalogue. Other people will have attempted to add to that, but it's not widely known about, it's not widely discussed in the same way that it feels to me, both inside of the genre, those of us who are fans of classic detective fiction, and as you say, those who are fans of more modern crime fiction who look back at it and go, oh, you can't have a Chinaman in your story, or you can't have the solution come to you by dreams, or I was going to have a Chinaman having a dream to get to the solution. You go, ha, 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 ha. So there probably have been attempts by probably too many people to write rules, but there doesn't seem to be anything that has really stuck with any other genre. You know, you think of, talk about Stephen King. I mean, technically, I know we can get down into subgenres, but technically something like Carrie and something like Dreamcatcher and something like Misery are all horror novels by the same guy working in the same genre, but I don't think you could find more than about 3 points that those three books have in common. Whereas, let's say you were to pick something like The Shop Window Murders by Vernon Loder, Case for Three Detectives by Leo Bruce, and The Burning Court by John Dixon Carr, to just throw in a complete curveball, you could find, if you go through the Knox Decalogue, you can find ways in which they observe them, ways in which they deliberately don't observe them. Despite them covering a range of things inside of the genre, you've got just a straight mystery, you've got a parody, and then you've got something which is a bit of a genre hybrid, which I'll probably get to talking about in a minute. It fascinates me, the idea that even inside of all of the subgenres and all of the sub-subgenres, everything comes back to essentially the same broad principles, not necessarily the Knox Decalogue, but the same several broad principles that no other genre has.
Maybe the borders of the detective fiction genre are arguably more defined than the fantasy and science fiction. Maybe fantasy and science fiction are a bit more nebulous. Because as you said, detective fiction, essentially we've got to have the murder or the crime, generally a murder. We've got to have some form of detective and some form of detection. So immediately you are kind of fencing off a part of a genre there. Whereas with science fiction, we could have time travel. It could be a time travel crime story. It could be a time travel love story. It could be a time travel revenge story. Yeah. We could have, you know, a story about a space elevator that's basically about the engineering of it and things like that. We could have a dystopia. We could have genetic engineering. And so it's much, for better or for worse, going back to the idea of constraint, the detective genre is a bit more constrained, which means it is, you can boil it down more than the other genres to the bare essentials, maybe of Knox's Decalogue, which isn't going to fit everyone. But as you said, you could point to Case for Three Detectives, you could point to a Peter Wimsey mystery, you could point to a Gladys Mitchell, and you'll find a murder, you'll find a detective, and you'll find detection, and you'll find a solution. Despite the very different points of view, styles, tricks, plot points of those authors. So maybe that's it, the murderer, the murderee, and the detection. And the detective, that is really what nails that genre down.
I mean, that's phenomenal then, isn't it? When you look at the fecundity of what has been achieved under those restrictions. I completely agree with you that, and I wrote a thing about it on my blog ages ago in defense of rules, I do completely agree that the observation of the rules is a great way to bring out creativity. But even inside of that limited range, the amount of stuff that has come out inside of even just broadly, let's say, the classic crime and detection genre, let's broaden it a bit so we're not talking exclusively about detective fiction, that's just incredible. It's absolutely incredible. You know, you could read Earl Stanley Gardner, and you could read Ellery Queen, and you could read Agatha Christie, and you could read Herbert Breen. Oh, that rhymes. And what you've read is 4 wildly different outputs by authors that vary from author to author, that vary from book to book, even inside of those authors. Even if you picked two or three years where those authors overlapped. I don't know if there is. Yeah, there would be. Even if you picked two or three years in which those authors overlapped, you're going to get such a staggering range inside of those conventions. That's that's mind-blowing, isn't it?
Yeah, I think the golden age of detection, I think, is such an incredibly inventive era of literature. And the weird thing is that up until, you know, maybe the last 20, 30 years, that genre was essentially a ghetto. You know, it was sneered at and looked down upon. It was escapist. It was trash. You would read it and throw it away. You know, who cares who killed Roger Ackroyd, that whole school. And, you know, it wasn't real writing. It wasn't real literature. And, in fact, many detective writers would have agreed with that, strangely enough. You know, some of them were very blasé about their output. And whether they, I mean, in print, whether they actually believed that inside, I don't know. And that's what, again, that's what I find really interesting, that it has changed now to a great extent. There are, I think it wasn't until the 70s or 80s you could actually study detective fiction at universities, but that's a good, you know, 40 years now.
Terrifyingly, yeah.
Yeah, terrifyingly, yeah. but still, and while the crime genre is still, I think, is the accounts for the most book sales of any genre, it's massively popular, I still think there's an inbuilt sneeringness towards the genre in modern terms. But even if that has given way, there can be a real sense of superiority, I think, looking back to the golden age. And I think you see that when you read articles in newspapers. It might be, say, Agatha Christie's 120th birthday or something, and some reporter has been sent, you know, has written a little thing, little article, and you can just, between the lines, it's like, oh yeah, we'll just bring it back to Christie. She wrote these funny little things, the mousetrap's still on. And it's such, you know, it's an extremely dismissive tone. And I think it's still inherent in a lot of critics, you know, critics who are not specifically working in the detective genre. Because you'll be reading reviews of other books, and they'll talk about, oh, it might be a detective novel, but it transcends genre. And in fact, this was a conversation that was had in Australia a few years ago, when there's a great Australian crime writer called Peter Temple.
Yep.
He was the first crime writer to be shortlisted for Australia's major literary award. It's like the Australian Booker Prize, which is the Miles Franklin. And there's a big conversation about, oh, but is it art? You know, and then eventually, I don't think he won the first time he was shortlisted, and then he won the second time. And you think that was maybe 2010, 2012. So you're still having that conversation about, can it be good, in inverted commas, writing if it's genre, if it's crime? And that's for a 21st century writer. And when you look back to the 20s and 30s, you know, to be honest, it can be sometimes easy to dismiss. You know, when I would quite happily pay money never to have to come across another London Bobby dropping his H's I'm so over that. So it's, you know, it's things like that you can certainly take the mick out of. But a writer like Agatha Christie, she was a great writer full stop in her prime. She wrote crisply, she wrote not a word wasted, and she could pull the wool over your eyes, and the plot zips along. And I think a lot of literary writers today could do with a bit more Agatha Christie, where it's just like, let us actually care about what happens in the next page, rather than just drown us in misery or drown us in this, like, nothing happens very slowly. There's nothing wrong with engaging the reader in a plot. Plot is not a dirty word. Yet in literary fiction, I think for some writers, they still think it is. And that's something that I am quite interested in, is the idea of genre as a way of dismissing something. Oh, he's just a crime writer. She's just a mystery writer. And that's something I find fascinating, because that genre can be positive. It can give the reader what they want, but it can also be almost derogatory as well.
There are three things that have occurred to me in what you've just said. The first is, you're absolutely right, these elements of dismissal inside of the genre that people are so keen to dismiss. And I wonder if an element of the dismissal of mystery writing, certainly from a modern perspective, is that there are undeniably cultural elements to it which are quite unpleasant to modern readers and to modern ways of thought. I mean, we know the way that anti-Semitism is handled in these books, the way that racism is handled, the way in which, you know, sort of a classism element creeps into all of it. There's almost an aspect of, because these books demonstrate that, the rest of it is probably not especially good as well. I mean, you know, we don't really talk about Edgar Rice Burroughs these days for more or less the same reason, right? Again, another hugely transformatively influential author on the adventure novel. You know, if you take Burroughs' stuff out of history, the way the adventure novel developed, the course of that changes, I would argue, to my dying day, immeasurably. But it's equally full of problematic attitudes and elements. And I wonder if, to a certain extent as well, this idea ties in then with what we talked about, this current crime writers being a bit kind of, oh, ha, 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 and being a bit dismissive about stuff in the past. And so we're not necessarily encouraged by the people who have built on those foundations to take it seriously, to enjoy it unselfconsciously, to be able to look at it and go, this is well written. Yes, unfortunately, you know, one of the finest crime novels ever written until the 1970s had a racial slur in its title. This does not stop it being, nevertheless, one of the finest crime novels ever written. Yes, elements of, I don't know, Ellery Queen, elements of John Dixon Carr, elements of Gladys Mitchell are going to have these attitudes at the time, which are not popular in the future. Doesn't stop the fact that, if we go back to this idea of plot, which I think we do again and again, it doesn't stop the fact that the plots are magnificently, or I mean, not Gladys Mitchell, but the plots are magnificently constructed. The plots are beautifully put together. And if you, you know, nobody sat down to write a complex murder mystery in 1934 with the intention of also trying to make it a treatise on everything that's wrong with a particular racial minority, right? That's not the intended purpose of these books. And so I wonder if the fact that they contain elements which are unacceptable in the modern age, and therefore authors who really should be championing them, people who frankly owe their careers to the likes of Agatha Christie, are dismissive of it. And so therefore this popular response to it tends to be that it's just guff. It's obviously not well written because elements of it are displeasing. I mean, that feels a bit like a straw man argument because I'm not able to cite specific examples. I know there was a conversation had at, I think, the Edinburgh Book Festival a few years ago with Abir Mukherjee and Val McDermott and somebody else, where they, at the very beginning, they get a bit kind of about the Knox Decalogue. And you go, well, with the greatest possible respect, you wouldn't be where you were it not for the fact that these books innovated inside of these constraints in a really quite staggeringly brilliant and imaginative way.
I'm sure we've all had that experience where we're reading, you know, we're really getting into a great detective novel and then someone comes out with an anti-Semitic slur or a racial slur, and it's like whoa, god, okay. It really, you know, takes out the book as it should. Yet there are definitely elements as a modern reader that are definitely problematic and that do mar the enjoyment of the kind of the fantasy, I suppose, of the novel. And that's something that's definitely could definitely be discussed and definitely taken on board. I don't know whether, though, I think if that is one of the reasons why the Golden Age has still been a little bit sidelined, I think it's maybe the latest in a long line of reasons. I mean, at the time of writing in the 20s and 30s, mainstream literature pretty much thought it was trash. The most influential critic of his generation, of the early to mid 20th century, Edmund Wilson, he thought the entire genre was trash. He quite liked, I think, Dorothy L. Sayers' writing style, but he just thought it was boring and why couldn't you write a proper novel rather than detective novel? So,
I mean,
at that point,
in fairness, he did read The Nine Tailors, which is boring.
Well,
I mean,
I'm going to step in right now and defend The Nine Tailors because that was, well, that was the novel that got me into detective fiction, believe it or not.
Good heavens.
After Agatha Christie, after reading Postern of Fate is my very first Agatha Christie.
It put
me off the genre.
Yeah.
And I was actually living in Africa. At the time I was teaching in Africa and there was literally nothing left to read except The Nine Tailors. I didn't know anything about it. And I thought I hated detective fiction and I read it. And yes, it was long-winded, but man, Yes, you do learn more about campanology than you ever really wanted to know. But what a solution. What a solution. That blew my mind. Again, that was the first time my head had been flipped, where the novel that I thought I was reading turned into the novel that was underneath that. So I've read a lot of detective fiction since then. I can see the Nine Tailors' flaws. It's not Sayers' best novel by any means, but no. I've got to jump in there and defend her for a second.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry. So, Edmund Wilson.
No. That side. So you had the original problem was it was, you know, trashy escapism. I think that persisted then. Then the next thing was when Chandler came along, Chandler and Hammett, and they just said, oh, it's a bunch of, you know, old ladies shooting each other with blowpipes full of curare. It's ridiculous. No one ever kills anyone like that.
I would read the hell out of that. That sounds amazing.
And, you know, Chandler said that Hammett brought detective fiction back where it should be, into the alleyway. Which, yeah, you could see that, you know, because Hammett and Chandler wrote about arguably the real reasons why people murder, which is sex and money, really. And, you know, if you want to be realistic about it. But, I mean, in the Golden Age detective novel, they did also murder for sex and money. Yeah. It's just a bit more muted. But so Chandler and Hammett come along, the hard-boiled school comes along and says, yeah, it's very middle class. And that, again, is taken up. There's a great study of detective fiction. I can't remember the author, called Snobbery with Violence. Colin Watson, maybe. And his argument was that, yeah, it was this, you know, detective fiction was very class-ridden, and it was basically middle-class people were reading it because they got to feel good about themselves. They read about people with servants, Peter Wimsey, Campion, cars. It was kind of an aspirational thing almost that they wanted. That was another issue with it, was the class consciousness. There's always been an obstacle to it being championed right from its inception. It just, the obstacle just seems to change, strangely enough. I don't know why. I think maybe it's because, or maybe the key thing that attracts criticism, that did attract criticism at the start, was that it was unpretentiously aimed to entertain. And as we all know, great literature is not meant to entertain.
The thing that gets me is people lump Chandler and Hammett in together as if they wrote the same kind of books, and they didn't. Because Hammett was a magnificent plotter. Hammett's plots are incredible. His characters are also beautiful. His prose is sharp and on point. And Hammett actually wrote well within the confines, if we like, these well-defined concepts that had to be observed of excellent crime and detective fiction. It happens his most famous book, The Maltese Falcon, is one of the worst crime novels ever written, but he was a magnificent writer and a magnificent plotter. I mean, don't tell me that the plot in Red Harvest is not as dense and complex as anything you've read from the Golden Age. That novel turns in the space of like a sentence. It's incredible. Chandler did not write that kind of stuff. Chandler's plots are awful. They're all over the place. Chandler was so much more concerned with form and with prose. He was not worried about what happened. He was more interested, after the big sleep, with effectively trying to write it in, I think the word he uses a lot is fizzy, trying to write it in a fizzy way. I've recently bought a collection of his letters called Raymond Chandler Speaking, and there's some really, really interesting stuff in there about how he sees his own writing and what he sees the purpose of his own writing to be. And it's fundamentally about the form rather than the function. And you can read so much of Chandler's stuff and just not really know. I've read pages of his books and gone, I got no idea what's just happened, but somebody's dead and now Philip Marlowe's outside or something, and that might be a police car, I don't know. I do think it was with Chandler that a lot of this sort of retroactive criticism really began, because Chandler was like, oh, you know, Hammett was one of us. And you're like, no, Hammett was nothing like you, or to perhaps put it the right around, you are nothing like Hammett. Chandler is not fit to spit on Hammett's street. Like, I wouldn't even let Chandler into the city limits when Hammett was there. They are in no way writing in the same school. But I do also think a lot of literary theory seemed to spring up around Chandler, and the fact that Chandler himself was quite dismissive. I mean, even someone like Freeman Wills Crofts, who is probably as archetypal a Golden Age detective writer as you're going to get, the quote that is trotted out, you know, Crofts was the soundest builder of them all. Even that was a backhanded compliment, because he said he's the soundest builder of them all when he doesn't get too fancy. Now, for Raymond Chandler to accuse you of getting too fancy, I don't know if you've ever read The High Window, it is practically unreadable, because he just wants to work in all of his fancy prose and all of his cool descriptions of things. The hard-boiled school is James M. Cain, who wrote inside of the tenets of what we would call classic era detective fiction. It's Dashiell Hammett, who wrote inside of what we would call the tenets of classic detective fiction. I will fight to the death over the fact that Raymond Chandler does not belong in that school. Raymond Chandler wants to be a literary darling, and he has no interest at all in actually legitimately great, plotted, well-written crime fiction.
Well, I'll take you up on that fight to the death. I've got to step, maybe not a fight to the death, but maybe some fisticuffs, I think, some light fisticuffs. I will say something in it, as I had to defend Nine Tails, I will defend Chandler. Chandler struggled with his plots. He was the first to admit that. I think I've read that book, and I'm pretty sure he does mention that in the letters. He struggles with his plots. And of course, I'm sure you know, I'll very quickly tell it, I'm sure you know the story of The Big Sleep. Who killed the chauffeur in The Big Sleep? The Big Sleep was adapted into a fantastic movie with Humphrey Bogart, and you know, there were two-thirds of the filming in the movie, and they realised they didn't know who killed the chauffeur in the movie. They cabled Chandler who killed the chauffeur, and the reply came back, "I've got no idea." He'd lost track of who killed who. So yes, but I've got to say, there's still space in my heart for Chandler. What, you know, again, there's a thin line between florid and evocative. And I just, for me personally, I think, you know, his prose is evocative rather than florid.
And he, you know, evocative of giving me a <word. laughs>
So, but no, I totally agree with you in that. I think Chandler was very consciously stepping away from what went before. And I think he was using, he was using Hammett somewhat dishonestly as well, as a buttress for his argument. And that, and again, I would agree with that maybe Chandler's railing against the artificiality of the form is partly because he couldn't quite seem to nail it in his own writing to write a coherent plot. And that's why he actually ended almost all of his novels are actually recycled short story plots. That he couldn't come up with another plot, so he had to go back and use a short story. Whereas, as we saw with Hammett, and I'm very lucky, I lecture at the uni and I get to teach Red Harvest in a few weeks.
Nice.
And it's fantastic. So, and Red Harvest is really, it's almost like the perfect melding of the hard-boiled and the golden age, in that you've got the great mystery element, but you've also got, as I say to my students, literally a murder every five pages. I think one of the chapters is actually called something like The 15th Murder. That's actually a chapter title in the book. But at the end it all makes sense. There's false trails, there's a murder, you know, there's red herrings, and it's absolutely fantastic. Arguably Red Harvest is the crossroads and the apex almost of the Golden Age meets the hard-boiled.
Given that we've hedged around the idea of the detection genre and fantasy or horror as separate genres, we should also discuss the idea then of genre crossovers and how probably the most successful detection and other genre crossover novels end up being probably more detection than they do anything else.
Don't almost like the detective aspect is like the hard stone in the middle, and it's like the snowball outside, the snow's packed outside is like the other genre kind of packed around it.
Nice.
One book I'd recommend, I don't think you've read it, is Carnacki the Ghost Finder by William Hope Hodgson.
I've read the Carnacki stories, yeah. They are very enjoyable for just how wildly they veer around, and that sometimes the whistling room is a literal whistling room and things like that.
That's the great thing. I wish you'd, I mean, they were quite formulaic, but the great tension in each one of the Carnacki stories, I should explain, Carnacki the Ghost Finder is one of the earliest Ghostbuster kind of characters. He's an occult detective, the early 20th century, and people call him like the classic detective to investigate supernatural happenings. But unlike John Dixon Carr's novels, with one very famous exception, the reader, along with Carnacki, doesn't know whether the occurrence is supernatural or not until the end of the story, basically. So there's a great tension there for both Carnacki and the reader. As we're going along and these weird things are happening, will it turn out to be actually a ghost or a weird demon, which it does happen sometimes? Yeah. Or will it turn out to be, you know, Old Man Jones from Scooby-Doo, which it does turn out to be sometimes? And that's, it's such a great central conceit that there have been many occult detectives, but as far as I know, no one has used that same trick that Hodgson did, which brings in that great tension of each story you go into. Is it a ghost story or is it a crime story? I don't know why that hasn't been done.
I wrote something on my blog a couple of years ago about how I think one of the great failures of The X-Files was that every single week it was aliens. Yeah. I legitimately think, you know, The X-Files was sort of influential and it was a relatively big deal, but I legitimately think The X-Files would have been a series for the ages and it would still be as wildly popular today if even one time in five or six there was a rational explanation to it. I think they really, really missed a trick there.
Yeah, definitely. And it also would have made Scully's character less silly, considering the amount of stuff she saw and how long she took to be convinced of the supernatural. Yeah.
Yeah, that's fair. Talking of genre hybrids, there's a very good collection of science fiction mystery novel, short story, I should say, hybrids written by Isaac Asimov called Asimov's Mysteries, where he laid out in the foreword this principle that people would see the science fiction genre as very much the antithesis of the mystery genre, because of course you could just turn around and say, oh well, I've got my Lioscope 734-D, so I can just point this at someone and find out who's lying and find that they're the murderer, which you absolutely can do, but there's no reason why you couldn't then introduce that into the world of the story and then try to tell a story around that. And there are some very, very, very interesting ones. One of them brilliantly is based on a scientific principle which was believed to be true at the time of writing, which has since been shown up to be false. And he has this very pithy comment along the lines of, well, if scientists can't get their facts right, I can hardly be expected to, or something like this.
Yeah, I've read those Isaac Asimov short stories. They were very good and fascinating. One in particular I remember where they managed to work out that someone killed someone and took his body to the moon or something and dumped it there. At the end of the story, they throw a ball at him and he can't catch it because he's lost his bone mass from... it's a great, really, you know, incredibly clever, but it was fair play, you know, it was set up in the story.
There are some great science fiction novels that cross over very well. The one that I have to always mention is Inherit the Stars by James P. Hogan. It's a fabulous impossible crime, effectively an impossible crime novel of a decayed human skeleton found in a fully functioning spacesuit deep enough on the moon that it's carbon dated at being like 10,000 years old or something like this.
That's a brilliant idea.
Oh, it's so, so, so clever. And Adam Roberts wrote a couple of sort of crossover science fiction detective books. The first one was The Real Town Murders.
I think Jack Glass was before that. Jack Glass.
Oh, yeah, good point. Yeah, he did do Jack Glass. Yeah, and in fact, Jack Glass was one where he said in the introduction, it was a very deliberate attempt to try to fuse the Golden Age detective novel with the Golden Era science fiction story. Some of them are more successful than others. One of them is essentially the retelling of a pre-existing impossible crime story. But it actually, the further I've got from it, the more I've appreciated how cleverly it updates the principle. I'm not going to name which one, because then the essential principle becomes very obvious. But the further I have got from it, the more I really liked that as an update. And yeah, the novel The Real Town Murders, which is a body appearing in the boot of a car in an entirely automated car production plant, with cameras everywhere, no humans go in. That's very, very, very cleverly done. He wrote the follow-up to that, By the Pricking of Her Thumb, which is more science fiction than detection. I mean, I really enjoyed it, and in principle it's a very good idea. It's effectively someone has been killed by being stabbed in the thumb with a pin, and there's no poison on it, so how could the death have occurred? It ends up being a much more science fiction-y solution, but the way what he does inside of the world, and this is what I really like about certainly the first Asimov, the Liege Bailey series, The Caves of Steel, is the way in which he marries this sort of detective plot on very classic grounds with a very interesting science fiction milieu. And in fact, it's on the back of things like that Adam Roberts novel, and certainly the Hogan one. I do think it is going to be inside of these genre hybrids that I think we're going to continue to find original solutions. I think they're going to be more and more spaced out. So I don't think you're going to get a new idea every year or a new idea every 2 years. It might be a new idea every 5 years. But I do actually think the future of original solutions to baffling situations rests in these genre hybrid detective novels.
Mm. Yeah, I could see that happening. I have read the Real Time Murders, which I thoroughly enjoyed. I think Adam Roberts does a better job, actually, than Asimov of marrying the two genres, I think. Having read all of Asimov's Bailey and Danilov stories, I think if we go back to the image of the sort of the hard stone and the snowpack around it, the very first novel, it's got, you know, a great hard stone detective novel with a little bit of snow around it, and as we get further along, the stone of detection becomes smaller and the snow becomes a globe, and you have endless discussions about, you know, I don't know, the society of Mars or whatever, and it becomes progressively more disappointing, very sadly. Yeah, I think one sort of crossover novel we haven't talked about yet, which is one of the biggest ones in the last few years, which is arguably science fiction / Golden Age detective, is The Seven Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle.
Which is fantastic.
And by Stuart Turton. Fascinating premise. It's kind of Groundhog Day meets And Then There Were None, almost, where a character is jumping between bodies, reliving the same day in a manor, a Golden Age manor, where there's a murder going to happen, and he knows the murder's going to happen. He's trying to prevent it, and I've summarised it very badly. But if we talk about Agatha Christie, you know, creating these plots with like a Swiss watch, I think Evelyn Hardcastle is like a quantum computer. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's incredibly complexly plotted, yet never confusing. I read at one point, I read an interview with the author who said, I think he had to stop writing for about 18 months because he was stuck. He'd written himself into a corner and he couldn't work out how to get out of it. And I thought, I could definitely see that happening. but it's a great book. And from what I understand, it was critically and commercially successful. It won a first book award from somewhere.
Costa,
yeah, which isn't even a crime.
No.
So it kind of, it, you know, in inverted commas, it transcended the genre. So that's encouraging. I mean, that's an example of, you know, a love letter to the Golden Age and an odd book and a very complex book.
Yeah.
Almost, arguably, far more complex than maybe 90% of your classic Golden Age detective novels. It was a massive hit, so that's absolutely fantastic. So long may Stuart Turton continue. I'm looking forward to reading that second novel and seeing where he goes from there.
Mm. We should also probably mention, because we won't be forgiven otherwise, there were elements of genre hybrids during the Golden Age itself. Agatha Christie wrote Death Comes as the End, which is a detective novel that happens to take place in ancient Egypt, but it is still at heart fundamentally a detective novel. John Dixon Carr, when he started to get into historicals, there are various ones where he sends a modern day 1950s protagonist back in time to the 1700s or to whatever time period they happen to be an expert on. You know, Fireburn, Devil in Velvet, things like that. But they are arguably much more detective novels that just happen to take place in the past because somebody wants to show off their research in a way that thankfully isn't too intrusive. I mean, I haven't read all of Carr's historical stuff, but arguably there's an element of genre hybrid in them. But I think probably what we've been talking about here is one where the element of time travel, like with Evelyn Hardcastle, features in a much more intrinsically crucial way.
Yes, I mean, you could do an entire podcast on historical mysteries. Obviously, it's a whole massive subgenre. So yeah, I don't know. Would we even describe that as a hybrid? I don't know. I loved the book. It's a great book. Death Comes as the End, but it's basically, it's as if Christie had transported a drawing room full of middle class English toffs into ancient Egypt, with their relationships intact, their mode of speaking intact. And that's nothing against the book. And considering it was, I think, the very first historical novel, it's, you know, it's great. It's got a good central mystery, which I enjoyed. But really, you know, I just imagine, I wasn't imagining these ancient Egyptians with their togas or anything. They were just in smoking jackets and evening dresses among the pyramids. And having read a few historical novels since then, I can see it has come a long way since then. But going back to genre for a second, one thing I wanted to ask you, because it kind of puzzles and slightly annoys me, is the way Golden Age detection or classic detection somewhere along the line transmogrified into the horrible term cozy detective fiction.
Yes.
And I could be doing a complete disservice to that genre, and I'm sure I am, and you might get some angry comments, but I've read a few. I'll plow ahead anyway. It just seems to me that this cozy genre, it all seems to be built around someone who's got a hobby, and they investigate a murder within that hobby. And generally, talk about formulaic, that would be formulaic. Am I wrong about that? I'm happy to be convinced it's not like that.
I don't think you're wrong. No, I've mentioned Noah Stewart earlier. I will mention here the late, great Noah Stewart, who would talk about hobby mysteries. There's a fantastic feature that he started on his blog called 100 Books You Should Die Before You Read. And one of the early ones was called I Shot My Bridge Partner. And go back and read it. I will provide a link for anybody listening to this in the notes of the show below. But effectively, it's someone who wanted to write a manual about the playing of bridge hands, and then there just happens to be a murder in there at some point somewhere along the lines. And yeah, I do think in much the same way that the classic era mystery, with all of its savagery, with all of the unhappiness of the background in which it was written, has been kind of sought to be declawed by modern critics and the modern mind. I do think in the same way, anything which is vaguely about sort of a murder and it's all a bit comfortable and everything's okay and it's someone knows about it because, you know, it relies on something to do with the running of a cake shop. Cozy is the perfect word for them because it's all tremendously comfortable. Everybody's very polite. There's never any risk. If somebody gets kidnapped or held at gunpoint, it's done in the most bizarrely unthreatening way possible. And I think that has become synonymous for a lot of modern critics with the classic era novel of detection, because they choose to, for the reasons previously discussed, dismiss the classic era novel of detection as something which is very light, which is very frothy, which is very consequence-free, because there's never really an examination of grief, of the pain it causes. All this stuff is skated over. But, as we said early on, it's not really the purpose and focus of these books. They're about plot. The reason that we talk about the Golden Age is because plot developed to a degree of artistry that I would say we haven't seen since. Otherwise we wouldn't be talking about the 20s to the 40s as the Golden Age. I think there's fundamentally just a misunderstanding about what the novels in the Golden Age were really about. There's definitely a misunderstanding about the context in which the Golden Age was written. And, you know, people overlook the fact that come out of World War, there was a global depression, come off the back of the Spanish flu. Like, there was so much going on that was so disruptive and causing such problems socially. You read these books and there's all these references to increased taxation, to the formation of the welfare state. Like, you don't have to be a hugely read-up social historian. I know all of this purely from reading these books and then having the luxury and the joy of being able to discuss them with other people who read them and understand them. If you look at Cozy Mysteries, there's none of that. There's no background to them. There's no sense of any wider sense of disorder. These people live very comfortably middle-class lives, and there just happens to be a murder. That's the sole source of disruption. And I think because there really isn't the understanding of the Golden Age novels, they are conflated. You know, I think it is the sort of parallel which is drawn by people who haven't really read either, but wish to appear either to profit off the cachet of Agatha Christie and the incredibly hard work done by these people when they were doing it properly, or who wish to appear better versed in their area of practice than they really are. Just think you can usually spot it as a lazy shorthand for someone who doesn't know what they're talking about.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Thanks. I think just the adjective cozy, in a sense, I can see why someone who didn't know a lot about the genre would apply to the Golden Age, but it's not. I don't think it's an adjective that anyone who's read widely in the genre would apply to that time. We have talked about the artificiality of the genre, and we have talked about how often murders are bloodless and the victim dies instantaneously and things like that. That's not to say that there aren't some disturbing elements there and there aren't some disturbing killers. For example, And Then There Were None. If you read that, not only is it amazingly plotted, but it's blooming disturbing as well. What the characters go through, the sufferings they have and the reason why it happens and things like that. And even things like Agatha Christie's After the Funeral, when you find out the motive for murder, and that is it's extremely disturbing and yet very understandable at the same time, and not cozy. I would not use the word cozy.
No.
So in a so it's strange because in a sense there's the surface elements of the genre are, in inverted commas, cozy. We've got the warm fireside, we've got the vicarage, we've got the library, we've got the small village, Mayhem, Parma, whatever. So, you know, we can see that, but if you read a John Dixon card, you know, there is evil that intrudes into this. It's certainly not full-on gore evil like in the movie Seven or something like that. We're not going to see body parts flying everywhere, but there is a sense of evil and danger. And the detective has to defeat that evil, and it, you know, it's not, yeah, just it's odd how that particular adjective has been sort of retrofitted to the Golden Age, because it's certainly not cozy.
I do think, in part, the corpse became glossed over because there was a recognition of the fact that the principles of death could actually themselves be quite good clues. And in the interest of trying not to muddy the waters too much, I do wonder if a lot of things were, oh, he was poisoned and we found him poisoned, rather than explaining the twisting and the agonized wailing that the body goes through, because we know, I mean, even from Christie's first novel, that there are different symptoms of death, whether somebody is poisoned with curare, whether they're poisoned with strychnine, whether they're poisoned with arsenic. Something like, say, Richard Austin Freeman's John Thorndike stories, where, you know, you get this one very key, tiny forensic detail which ends up unpicking the whole thing. Authors who understood the impact of a particular method of death and would make that part of their cluing would probably include that detail. So you would look at the shape of the edges of the wound, for instance, or you would describe the way in which the body twisted, or whether somebody lost their speech, or whether the tongue was swollen and things. But almost purely from a cluing perspective. I mean, Chandler is right to an extent in that there is definitely a strata of mystery novels that kill somebody purely to provide a corpse, and the clues are who could have come in and out of the room, who could have been in the house, why is there a footprint outside in the middle of the lawn but there are no other footprints around it, etc., etc. And so I think the accusation of principles of death being deliberately sanitized partly come from the fact that there was a really good understanding about if you are misdescribing something, then potentially what you're providing is not only a red herring, but you're incorrectly providing a red herring, because you end up describing a poisoning by strychnine, which is actually a poisoning by curare, and the people who know about these things would probably write in. But also because there are definitely people who just needed a body so that they could put their clever alibi problem into pursuit. So it doesn't matter how the bullet passed through the brain. The fact that a bullet has passed through the brain is in of itself perfectly fine. There's a hole in there, there's a bit of blood, we've got a dead body, now we've got to find out where everybody was. And I feel sometimes as if that ends up being ignored.
I never thought about the forensic aspect in terms of not looking at the dead body. For me, that's a really great point for me, and I could be wrong about this. I just thought it would be an offence against good taste back then to describe in detail, like, the raggedness of a wound in a woman's chest or whatever.
Yeah, but I mean, there are definitely books that do. We're not pawing over it with bloodlust in our eyes as we go on. But if you look for it, there are definitely books that do describe, you know, the shape of the edges of a knife wound. I mean, Agatha Christie very famously wrote a novel where the room is entirely covered in blood, and the dedication at the start is because this is somebody said to me, I just want you to write a murder where there's absolutely no doubt that there's blood everywhere. And she does it, but it also goes on to become a very clever clue. Like, it's not done purely to sate the desire for bloodlust in one of her friends or one of her associates or whatever. She does it and then turns that into an element of the plotting and the cluing that helps get to the basis of the mystery.
Yeah, good point.
So then, if we were to attempt to gather all of this together to give some notion of what we think we've achieved today, what do you think we've achieved today in discussing this?
Well, I think we've covered a lot of ground in talking about the detective fiction genre, but I think there's a lot we did not touch on, or only barely touched on. And I think that is a demonstration, again, of maybe the complexity of the detective genre, even the golden age of detection, in that Again, critics might sometimes dismiss it as a simplistic genre, pure escapism, pure entertainment, cardboard characters, you know, doesn't have anything to say, completely unbelievable candy floss entertainment, when in fact that is a grave disservice to a very complex genre that has its roots back in the early 19th century and its outward branches still kind of flowering today across many different subgenres and crime and mystery and thrillers and things like that. So I think, yeah, I think that if we've discovered anything, it's that the detective genre is far more complex than you'd think with just those two words, detective and fiction. It covers an infinity of subgenres and rules and exceptions and everything like that.
Mm. I would agree. It is incredibly complex. It is so complicated, and there are so many elements of it to draw into. We're not claiming at all to have been exhaustive in this. There is so much to it. It really does feel like we've only just scratched the surface. Maybe we'll have to pick this up again at some future point. And, I said a couple of weeks ago, my audience is 14 detective fiction nerds. I think it's dropped down to about 11 now. So every list, I'm not going to be able to launch a Patreon on the back of this, am I? Absolutely useless.
You should retitle it, My Dad Wrote a Detective Novel.
Like, I just make up chapters as I go along each week. Yeah, maybe. Thank you so much for taking the time to this. This has been a huge amount of fun. I urge everybody listening, not because he's threatening me or saying that I should, genuinely do go out, check out The Drover's Wives. Also check out as well Their Brilliant Careers, which is a fantastic set of interlinked short stories with sort of detective novel elements to it, aren't there, in that, I suppose we could say.
Yeah, and Their Brilliant Careers is a series of fictional biographies of made-up writers, and one of them is a Golden Age crime writer, and a lot of fun writing about her. But for detective fans, there is actually inside the book, buried inside it, a murder with clues, and one of the characters in the book does kill another character, but it's never explicitly spelled out. So no one's ever got it, so... But yeah, maybe you might be the first, so why not go and buy it?
I was very, very proud when I read it. I was like, oh, it's because this one killed that one. And Ryan went, well, yeah, obviously, no, it's much more complicated than that. I was like, oh, crap. So, thank you for taking the time to talk about this today.
No, thanks, Jim.
Listeners, I urge you to go and buy Ryan's two books. And I'll see you again, and I'll see you guys listening again. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, everyone. Bye-bye.